WHYY is proudly supported by Penn Medicine. From groundbreaking discoveries to life-saving care, Penn Medicine's innovation is helping to change lives, one moment, one treatment, one patient at a time.
I think people assume that band leaders are responsible for the sound of a band. How much credit do you think belongs to the arranger for how a band ends up sounding?
Well, I think it's a labor of both people talking about what it is. Generally, when we start writing for a band, the band has been in existence and it has a sound, and it's not too difficult to duplicate the sound on paper. And a lot of times, I think when a band leader would call me, they want an original piece from me or an arrangement of somebody's tune, and they have heard my charts, and they know what I like or write like, and I guess they say, well, let's have a couple of Manny Albums charts in the book. But it works both ways, because we know what the band sounds like as arrangers, and so I wouldn't write anything for Woody Herman, let's say, the same thing that I would write for Stan Kenton or something like that.
What would be the difference between what you'd write for Herman and the way you'd arrange for Kenton?
Well, just the overall style is totally different. The two bands had totally different styles. I say had in the Kenton sense and have in Woody's sense, but Woody's band keeps changing. You know, every 5 years or so, it's got a different sound. And it's not really that difficult to emulate somebody else's original work. I mean, that's what arrangers do in a sense. It's not what I do as a composer, but as an arranger, it's part of my job.
Do you think of yourself as having a sound?
Yes and no. Every couple of years it changes, but in the times that I was doing a lot of heavy recording on with my own bands or whatever, I did have a sound for a while, and then it would change because the projects would change. Suddenly the producer would call me and say, well, do something with strings next time, and that's got to change the sound right off the bat. Right now I've been doing some stuff for the Philadelphia Pops, and I'm also going to write for the Dallas Pops, and they're going to be two different styles of charts. They can't be the same.
So, what do you think of when you think of the Philadelphia Pops?
Well, I think of what Peter Nero thinks about, because it's his orchestra in a sense. And we talk things through and all that, but he leaves things up to me. He's heard what I do, and he said, well, write some charts for us. Now, Dallas has got a different orchestra. They have a different sounding brass section. They have a different sounding percussion section. And so we're going to do a different thing there than we do here in Philly.
Well, let's listen to one of your arrangements with your band of a Cole Porter song, Anything Goes. And this album has just been reissued. Can you tell us about the arrangement?
This is the first album that I've ever done under my own name. I had been writing for bands and everything, and the producer, Jack Lewis, at the time at Victor, said, well, why don't you do your own album? Come on in and we'll choose some things. And my idea was to get some of my favorite soloists together. And what you hear is two trumpets, two trombones, and two saxophones. And they would, the personnel would move around, but it was always the same. In other words, I had three favorite trumpet players, or four, and I only had room for two, so that we did three separate sessions and did some leapfrogging with the personnel. On this thing, you'll hear Bob Brookmeyer on trombone. You'll hear Al Cohn on tenor saxophone. Philadelphian Nick Travis, he was a Philadelphian. Went to Massbaum High School here, and where all the good musicians went, I guess. And I think you'll hear Jim Nottingham also on trumpet. Sol Schlinger was the other saxophone player, and Milt Hinton and O.C. Johnson were the rhythm section. There was no piano on this, because the soloists have the confidence to be able to play without a piano. So,
what do you like that arrangement of the two sets of the horns?
I don't know. I came up with that because it was different. It was at that time, Miles Davis's Tentet had been out for a little bit of a while, and people were leaning towards smaller bands. Plus, this is my first album, and the budget wasn't that big. You know, they said, well, you know, don't take 18, 20 men in the studio. See what you can do with a small. And it was fun. This was really a lot of fun. And besides, you know, it's harder to write for a small group than it is for a big band.
Okay, and we'll talk about why in a couple of minutes.
Okay.
This is from the album, Manny Album, The Jazz Workshop, and his arrangement of Anything Goes. We'll be right back. Just heard Manny Album's arrangement of Cole Porter's Anything Goes as recorded in 1955. Nick Travis, Jimmy Nottingham on trumpets, Bill Byers and Bob Brookmeyer on trombones, Al Cohn tenor saxophone, Saul Schlinger baritone saxophone, Milt Hinton on bass, O.C. Johnson on drums. That session just reissued on a French RCA album called Manny Album, The Jazz Workshop. And my guest Manny Album is currently teaching at Glassboro State College in addition to his writing and arranging work. You said before we heard that it's sometimes more difficult to write for a small band than a big band. Why would that be more difficult?
Well, with a big band, you've got a lot of power, and you can hide things inside the band. The things can be hidden, wrong moves in a voice leading or whatever, if we talk technically about it. With a small band, every instrument sticks out on its own. You can hear each one, and you can't make a wrong move, and it's more difficult. You have to sometimes let notes out of a chord go. And you have to choose which ones you don't want or which ones wouldn't be as good, or the ones to let go, actually. And for me, the little bands are more wieldy in a sense because they can fly a little bit more. People are not dependent so much on the other people in the band, and therefore you've got to get good soloists and good players. But they generally wind up being happier than they are in a big band to begin with. So that you get everything turns out nicely when you do this. Unfortunately, the bands I've been writing for are getting bigger and bigger, so it's hard to get back and do things like this. So it's good to hear them again. I haven't heard this one in 20 years at least.
How did it sound to you?
Sounded good. They remastered it very well. We were talking about that while the thing was playing. I think it's a better issue than the original one. And whoever did it, I must write them a letter or something. I didn't know about this until 2 days ago that it had been re-released. So
I know musicians are frequently not told about re-releases of their records.
Never, it looks like. Because Victor released two of my albums and these other people released the one we heard first. I think three or four of them coming out on that label. And we're the last to know, I guess.
When you're compiling a band, when you're getting together the musicians for a band, how are you going to balance their work as a section player with their work as a soloist?
Well, most of the guys that I hire, and it's not really hiring, it's just calling my friends and say, hey, we got a recording session, come on in, and, they get paid for it. But most of those people do as well either way. I mean, anybody I hire is a great soloist and a good section player, so I don't have any problems with that. They all read magnificently. It's a thrill. When we sit and write, or when I sit and write, I'm generally in the basement of my house, and it's like you're lonely. You sit there a couple of days and you write an album or whatever. And when you hear that first couple of chords coming out of the band, it sounds better than you conceived it. These people are great players, all of them. And nobody realizes that, or few people do anymore because the situation has changed in the recording. But in the original days of recording, nobody saw the music until the session. There was no rehearsal before the session. Now, what you heard there was the third time these people had played through the arrangement, and it was good. And that's it. So,
when this piece was recorded that we just heard in 1955.
Was it 55?
Yeah.
I thought it was 56 or 7, but okay.
You also had a larger band, I think, that was playing it around then. Was there much work for big bands in the mid-50s?
In those days, I never had a band that went out and worked only three times in my life did I take a band anywhere to work. The bands that I had that were larger or smaller in some instances were just recording bands, and those were the same people that recorded for almost everybody else. But, you know, they're great studio players and good jazz players. Before that, I had been working in big bands, but other people's bands. So that, you know, that's another kind of thing, and that's how I learned to write, actually, because I sat there and listened to what was being written and first trying to emulate what was being written and then had ideas of my own, and the writing grew at that point.
You started in big bands as a baritone player.
Yeah, baritone sax, yeah.
When you gave that up to devote all your attention to writing and arranging, why did you give up the instrument?
Well, I'll tell you, I would have had to make an investment. I don't mean a financial investment, but an investment in practicing. When I got off the road, I was about 28 years of age. And in order to make it as an instrumentalist in New York, I would have had to start learning the flute, the oboe, buy a whole bunch of instruments. Not that that was the throwback, but the practice. I'd probably have to take 2 years off and practice these things until I got good enough to be able to sit down in the studio and play. At the same time, the writing assignments were really piling up on me. And I just figured that rather than be sort of half player and half writer, I figured I might as well be a writer. I had served my time on the road. It was, you know, some amazing experiences in 12 years in traveling and all that. And to put another 3 or 4 years into learning new instruments and the rest of that, I felt that right there and now I could be writing and earning a living. And I always enjoyed writing as much as playing. And it was a sacrifice. I miss it, but I haven't picked up an instrument since.
Why wouldn't you pick it up and play it a little bit?
First of all, I'd be very rusty. You know, I haven't had one in my hand. And as a matter of fact, I turned around to a saxophone player that was sitting next to me in the Paramount Theater in New York when I quit after the last show. And I said, Al, you've always wanted this instrument here. It's yours. And he still has it. It's a long time. And I can go visit it, but I don't want to play it. I wouldn't do it justice, you know.
So you don't even want it around?
No. Rather than, I had a clarinet, which I gave to a student that used it much, much more than I did. And he turned out great. Great player.
Do you compose and arrange at the piano?
Yeah, at the piano or sometimes in taxi cabs or airplanes. But I prefer the piano to work with. I'm not a good pianist, but it helps. You know, it helps you orient yourself to the sounds. And then you have to imagine each finger as being another instrument sometimes. So that's a whole other, it's a whole other thing.
Let's listen to another one of your arrangements. And you did a jazz version of West Side Story. This was staged, wasn't it?
Well, not my version, no. The only authorized version to be staged is the one that originally came out in, when was that, 57, I guess. No, this was an album which was actually an assignment by the record company to go see the show and see if I could do a jazz version of it. And I had a lot of trepidations about it until Bernstein called me up. He had been in Europe, and he came back and heard the album and loved it. So I guess that started some other balls rolling. But no, this was never staged this way.
What were you thinking about when you wrote it? What musically did you have in mind?
Well, this was a bigger band than the other one, but not a real big band. It was somewhere in between. I think there were 13 or 14 people involved rather than the normal 18 that you hear. What I had in mind was the show floored me, really. When I sat and watched the preview, I began to realize that it wasn't a regular musical. It was like an opera because it was, there was a sadness in it, and it wasn't. It ended in disaster for all the characters, which Broadway shows, musicals never do. And I felt that there was a lot of material in the show that the players could have a lot of fun improvising around, and I changed some stuff around. That's where the trepidation came in, because I thought Bernstein might, you know, kind of not like me to have done it, but I did, and he liked it, and so it was kind of a good... this, incidentally, got me a nomination for a Grammy. I didn't win it, but at least it was part of that year's nomination. And I really enjoyed this. I don't really remember doing one of the sessions. I woke up on a Sunday, and the producer called me. He said, did you see the show? And I said, yep. And he said, well, the music is on its way. We're going to start recording Wednesday, Thursday, and Friday, and we have to have it out next Monday. So it gave me about 2.5 or 3 days to write, And I was so kind of out of it that I don't remember the last session at all. I did one session, had to come home and write the next one and keep doing it that way.
Well, I think you remember the one we're going to hear, which is Somewhere, that features soloist.
Oh, I remember it all now.
Okay. Do you want to say anything about Somewhere?
Well, Bob Brookmeyer is an enormous talent, I think, and he breathes his own personality into everything he plays. And the minute I heard this tune, I figured, well, Brookmeyer is the guy to play it. He does it very simply. There's hardly any kind of pyrotechnics. There's a little trumpet solo that goes on over him in a mute, and that is by Nick Travis again, who was one of my favorites in those days. He's gone now, but he was quite a player, and we all kind of loved to hear him play and loved to use him on sessions and everything.
Okay, this is Manny Album's arrangement of Somewhere from his album of jazz arrangements of the music from West Side Story. Manny Album's arrangement of Somewhere from West Side Story, featured on an album of his arrangements, his jazz arrangements of songs from the show and the movie. Manny Album is my guest. He's currently teaching at Glassboro State College and lives in New York. You said that you had really gotten your training as an arranger when you were on the road playing baritone in different big bands. Did you get a sense of what kind of arrangements you liked and hated being a performer in the bands?
Oh, sure. That's one thing that made me start writing is that there were a lot of things I didn't like to play at all. They were very awkward. Not that they didn't sound good, but they could have been better written, I thought. Everybody in those days was experimenting, I must say. You know, I'm talking about a long time ago. I'm talking about the 40s, the beginnings of the 40s. And there were some bona fide arrangers around, Fletcher Henderson and Ellington and people like that. And then everybody else we all experimented. We would bring something in and the band leader would either like it or not. And a lot of them were very helpful in saying, well, here's what I don't like about it. If you change this, we'll do it. You know? And so you'd go back and change it. We all learned from each other. It was kind of like street music in a sense because there was no place to go to school and learn any of this. That happened after World War II, that, you know, the GI Bill of Rights opened up a couple of music schools and things of that nature. But In those days, but we did have some great people to hang out with and learn from, people like Dizzy Gillespie and Bud Johnson and Charlie Parker. And those are the guys that taught us, in a sense, because they just by talking with us, not by – and I played with some of those guys. So it was you know, you go to a cafeteria and order a cup of coffee, and 6 hours later you've had a great music lesson, you know.
Can you think of something that you tried to avoid in your own charts after having played other people's?
Anymore, it's hard. What I tried to avoid was getting bored writing it. I think that's the basic thing. And things that I would feel might be a little bit boring for somebody to listen to, repetitive things and things of that nature. Although repetition is what makes a lot of jazz and a lot of especially rock music, you know. But I think it was the idea of not trying to do anything that was boring or banal or in those days, I guess the word was commercial. You know, we didn't. I was very fortunate in all the bands that I played with and wrote for that they weren't real commercial bands. They were after good jazz music, Charlie Barnett and Charlie Ventura and those guys.
Yeah, how have you tried to keep the balance in your life between the commercial jobs that will help pay for your life and the jobs that are, you know, thoroughly or artistically fulfilling but might not net you a lot of money?
Well, lately, my source of income has been from teaching. I teach 3 days a week here, and I'm home for 4 days a week, and I can write. I get a lot of grants from people, from the NEA and other people, and I get commissions from orchestras and other places and soloists and people like that. And when I do something that's commercial, it doesn't take that much time. My time. I got a reputation back in the 50s of being very fast, and that helps because I don't have to spend hours agonizing over something that is just a very quick commercial. You know, sometimes to write 60 seconds worth of music can take 2 or 3 days. I wanted to avoid that, so I kind of train myself to write quickly and get all that over with and then spend time on what I want to do. Which is now writing for large orchestras, soloists with large. I just finished a piece for Bud Shank with the big L.A. orchestra. I'm working on a concerto for Jim Hall now, the guitarist, which I'll probably finish in May. And I'm doing occasionally. I'll do charts. If Peter Nero calls me tomorrow, he did 2 weeks ago, and I came up with something for his concert that was last Monday. I can spend a weekend doing that, and it doesn't really take all my time, and it's not boring like some of the older stuff used to be. So.
Is there any kind of job you would turn down because you found the music unappealing?
Yep. Yeah, there's a lot of them. I wouldn't want to go into a studio anymore and do what they call sweetening today. You know, you wind up with somebody's track, and they say, well, write strings around this and write some brass. We need some brass here, and we need strings here. I think anybody can do that anymore. I've been fortunate. I think the teaching offers me enough financial security to be able to say no to a lot of gigs that I would ordinarily had to have taken about 10, 12 years ago. So.
What's the rationale behind sweetening? I'm the kind of person who tends to like the pre-sweetened music a lot better. Does it really sell better and have more appeal with the strings?
Well, you know what the rationale is, really? The rationale was, I think, I shouldn't say this in all seriousness, but I think a lot of it was forced on us by the people that are inventing tape machines and more tracks. The more tracks they have, the more they have to kind of say, well, you know, we got 24 tracks, but and you tell them, well, we only have 4 musicians. Why do you need 24 tracks? And they say, well, later on you can put the strings on or you can do this. My philosophy about music is that I hear it all at the same time. And when I go into a studio to record, I want the whole thing live. I do that. I used to do that with singers. Occasionally, they might go back and fix something up a little bit. Dionne used to do that. I worked for Dionne Warwick. And everything she did was live, but she'd say, gee, I don't like that little two-bar thing in the middle. Let me fix that. And they would punch her in, and she would fix it up. But normally, she was in the studio. The orchestra was in the studio, and you get a little bit of love going on between those people. Instead of like cold, you know, I ran into a friend of mine on the street the other day. He's carrying his saxophone, and he's kind of shaking his head. And I said, "What? You know, where have you been?" He said, "Well, I just did a session." Said, yeah, who was on it? He said, "I don't know. It was just him, him, and earphones and his saxophone. He had no idea who the other musicians were." Now, that's kind of strange.
It is.
You know, and he asked the producer, he says, hey, I don't know who the bass player was, some guy in Nashville. You know, he didn't even know. It's kind of a strange thing when you grow up really loving the people that you work with, you know, and you live with them. You're part of a family, and suddenly you're making music with people you have no idea. I think there's something wrong with that. So I try to avoid that. I'm not really interested anymore in making a fortune. So and I think I feel better because of it.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Well, I'd like to play another one of your arrangements, and this is for your own composition. It's called Thruway, and it's from an album that was on Dot Records called Jazz New York.
Uh-huh.
Can you tell us a little bit about this?
Well, at one time I had bought a little sports car, and I took it out on the New York Strait Thruway, which was kind of like, you know, like the Jersey Pike or something. And it was fun. And when I got the album to do... The producers were always letting me have my own way when I did my own albums. They never really told me how to approach anything. And the thing with me was to get the guys I like to hear play, both as we talked about, both as players, you know, section players and soloists. And the writing, most of the writing that I do, I think, is about equally divided between the solo material and the written material, if not more solo material than written. Because I love to sit there and listen to these fellows play and get paid for it. It's marvelous. So I think on this you'll hear Pepper Adams on baritone saxophone. He's another reason I quit playing. When you listen to him play, you don't want to pick up a horn and start working like that. This is one of Donald Byrd's first recording sessions when he came to New York from Detroit. Al Cohn again and Bob Brookmeyer again, I think, and... if I've missed somebody along the way, we'll pick it up after it's over.
And what year was this recorded?
I think somewhere around 1960 or 59 or somewhere way back there.
Okay, well, this is Thruway, composed and arranged by my guest Manny Album.
Thank you.
Thruway composed and arranged by my guest Manny Album and featured on his album Jazz New York. You're teaching now at Glassboro, but before you started teaching there, you were also teaching in prisons.
Well, yeah, it was a little more than teaching, as a matter of fact. My teaching actually started at the Eastman School of Music. I'd been there for about 26 years in the summertime, and I thought that would assuage my guilt about not teaching steadily. And for a while, I was with the National Academy of Recording Arts and Sciences, which, you know, now they do the Grammys and things like that. But in order to spend some of our money, we had to have some projects going. And I arranged some liaison with the New York State Council on the Arts to begin to bring some maybe happiness to the prisoners. It was a hard thing to do. And there were a lot of musicians in the jails in New York. You know, unfortunately, generally it's on drug-related things and all that. But we'd bring them instruments. Some of the guys that I knew had instruments they hadn't played for years and, you know, didn't know what to do with them. I kind of got them together, and I'd go up with a station wagon full of horns and see if anybody could use them. And I would go once a month to two prisons, which were all over the state, but there would always be two that weren't too far away from each other. I could visit one in the morning and one, and I would rehearse the band and talk to them and give them some theory lessons on the blackboard, you know, things of that nature. And unfortunately, the money ran out for that, the state money. The academy money was, it was hard. It was a hard fight with them. But, you know, I enjoyed doing it. I thought it was something that had to be done because, you know, those people have nothing else to do. But the music is something that brings something into their lives that they don't really get in the prisons.
I know when I interviewed Art Pepper, he had said that when he was in prison, that there was a real division between the white and black prisoners, and he knew a lot of black musicians in there who he wanted to play with, but it was really not acceptable to play together.
Yes,
it was kind of dangerous, he said, to play together. Did you find that kind of thing to be true?
Well, not really. I'm trying to think, and I'm thinking back to Greenhaven, which was one of the heavy jails up in New York State. And I think that was an all-black band, now that I think of it, and you know, they kind of looked at me strangely until one of the guys came up with an encyclopedia in jazz and said, "Hey, you're in here." and then they realized that I had been writing for Count Basie and people like that were, you know, racially acceptable to them, and then they began to accept me. Now, I used to walk in there with a woman from a pretty, you know, good-looking gal from the Council on the Arts, and I would imagine that she was petrified to do this, but she would do it, and it was a strange experience. When those gates close behind you, you know that you can't just saunter in and out of that place. But after a while, I think we got the confidence of the musicians especially, and then the other guys that were in the yard. Sometimes you'd have to walk through the exercise yard, and they'd all look at you, especially the girl, and it was a little bit frightening. Ultimately, we got concerts together. Earl Hines did a few, and people like Thad Jones and Mel Lewis took some people up there. Pepper Adams, as a matter of fact, who you just heard on this thing. And we started kind of a network of people that wanted to do these concerts. And they got paid just minimum, just expenses, and on their days off, they would go up and do some of these things. And the bottom dropped out of it. It's a shame that the Arts Council just ran out of money. And they, you know, they couldn't even afford to hire a bus for us to use and things like that. I still try to do it. If I'm up in Rochester, New York, and I can make some kind of liaison up there with some of the prisoners and some of the jails, I'll spend an afternoon if I can, you know, if I can get out there or something. But I also set up, which is still going, and I feel good about, is teachers that were in the area that would go in and teach. And I guess they get some kind of minimum pay for it. And they enjoy doing it. You know, something that I think that should be done. And without mentioning names, there have been two or three guys that came out of the New York State system that are into music very heavily now and doing very well at it. Unless they, in their bios, they're going to list that as being part of their past, I wouldn't want to point the finger at them.
I'd like to talk about some of your work scoring movies. And before we talk about movies that you've scored, maybe we can listen to a selection of an album of arrangements that you did of movie themes.
Oh, yeah. Not my themes, other people's themes, but okay. The Green Leaves of Summer, I think that's Dmitri Tiomkin. And again, you're going to hear Bob Brookmeyer, but you're going to hear now Jim Hall, my favorite guitar player of all times, I think, and Johnny Coles on trumpet. Johnny is also, I think, a Philadelphian or a Camdenite, or and a marvelous player and a very beautiful man. So this is that, and this is with slightly a bigger band than what you've been hearing.
Okay, let's hear it. We heard Manny Album's arrangement of Green Leaves of Summer written by Dmitri Tiomkin from an album called Jazz Goes to the Movie. Jazz Goes to the Movies, Manny Album and his orchestra. Jim Hall was the guitarist. Bob Brookmeyer, the soloing trombonist.
And Johnny Coles.
on trumpet.
Yeah.
Now, you were, maybe you can name some of the movies that you've
scored.
Well,
there's a thing called Four Clowns. There was a thing called Around the World of Mike Todd, which was a whole other kind of... They shot a picture of him shooting a picture of something else when he did Around the World in 80 Days. A thing called Dancers in May and a whole bunch of things for NET. There was a series called Glory Trail, which had to do with the way the West really was. Some stuff for ABC when we did a couple of shows that were kind of specials, you know. But it's the same. They were almost live. They were like treated as live shows, but it's the same thing when you score for dramatic things.
What do you need to know about what's happening in the film before you write the score? What do you need to know about the mood and the texture, the pacing of what's happening?
Well, you have to
film?
Know a lot. The one thing that you really have to know is not to tip off anything that might be in the storyline later on by what you're writing. A lot of times you see rushes. And they'll show you scenes, but you don't know where the scenes are because sometimes the director doesn't know where the scene is yet until it's all shot and then the editor gets it. And so that you don't want to describe what's happening on the screen unless it's a chase or something. Then everybody gets excited. But one thing you don't want to do is follow the action. In other words, if somebody is in a particular form of action, what you want to really describe is their state of mind, not what they're doing. In other words, if you see somebody driving a car, it's a cliche to have car driving music. You can do that. That's very simple. But if they have some fearfulness or they have some happiness or whatever, that's the kind of thing that you want to do is describe what their frame of mind is. But you also don't want to describe it because in such a way as it might tip off a surprise that might happen. You know, you can take a doorknob and zero in on the doorknob with a camera, and as the knob turns, the music can dictate what can be behind the door. It can be almost anything, and by sometimes two or three notes, you've shown what's behind the door just with the music that you write.
Do you compose and conduct with the film in front of you?
Sometimes, but the techniques now are you measure everything by the frame. I mean, everything is absolutely frame to frame to frame, and there are electronic devices now that count tempo for you and all that, so you don't really have to see the film. If it measures out correctly, film goes by at 24 frames per second. Therefore, every tempo is a part of 24 frames. 12 frames is a tempo of a metronome tempo of one beat every half second, and so it goes, so eighths of a second and quarters and the rest. So it's very, very accurate. You can't go wrong. Therefore, you don't really need the film. Now, occasionally, when we don't want to, we want something to really work another way. We want it to be... kind of ad-lib tempo, and then the metronome doesn't help you, and then you do conduct to the film. But that you do with a stopwatch in front of you. So that it's kind of, it becomes simple after a while. It's very complicated in the beginning, but like anything else, when you get to know it, it's easily done.
You're teaching now at Glassboro State College, where you also lead the jazz band.
Mm-hmm.
You've worked in the period before musicians went to school to study jazz. You've worked with musicians who learned on the road like you did, and you've worked and taught musicians who did a lot of their learning in school. Do you think that there's any kind of qualitative difference between the kind of background that you get through going out on the road in a band and studying in a school with a jazz program?
There is, in a sense, but things have changed a lot as far as music goes and the kind of experience that somebody gets working at music rather than just studying at it. I don't know. I haven't been able to make up my mind. I know one thing, that if I had the chance to go to school I graduated when I was 16 years of age. I got out of high school. That was kind of lucky for me. And I was on the road by the time I was 17. I had put in about three quarters of a year. But I think if I had a chance to go and learn what I wanted to learn in the school, I might have taken it. you know, in a good school. But it wasn't available then. I can't make that. It's funny. I can't make that qualitative thing. I know we talked just recently about you had Phil Woods on the program, and he sort of takes to task some of the teaching that's done. But then again, he teaches, and he's had music camps and things like that. You know, Michael Brecker was in as a 13-year-old kid. I remember him in one of Phil's camps, you know, people like of that caliber. I haven't made up my mind yet, excepting that when you see the bands now of Buddy Rich or Woody Herman or Basie in some instances, whoever is left in the big bands, the graduates of Eastman School of Music, North Texas State, Miami, Maynard Ferguson's got a couple of kids from Miami in the band. Basie's got guys, the younger people have come out of schools. And I think from having heard jazz festivals, and I go and I'm an adjudicator at some of them, that the bands that are in some of the colleges today are better than the bands I played with when I was on the road. You know, I really think so. Mm-hmm. They're much more equipped technically to cope with and the music is much more difficult. It's not easy like it used to be. So,
are there any other projects that you have coming up? You told us about some of the commissions that you're working on before.
Well, projects are always kind of open up to me. I do a lot of I've been writing chamber music lately.
Yeah, right.
And soloists will call me. I've done things like with trombone and string quartet, tuba and string quartet, things of that nature, which take my mind off just what the jazz scene is, and it kind of makes me feel good when I sit down and write some more jazz pieces. It feels like I'm fresh all over again, like it's not all these years of writing and writing. But the basic thing, I think, is that the next project, as I said, was a concerto for Jim Hall and orchestra, and we're going to try to actually get Previn to do it at Pittsburgh or in London in one place, so which is great and fun. And Jim is such a sensational musician that, you know, it's an honor to sit down and write, and he's an old friend. Yeah.
Well, I really hope I get a chance to hear that. And I want to thank you so much for visiting with us today and for bringing some of your recordings with us. We've gotten a chance to hear a span of your work. It's really been fun, and I want to thank you very much.
It's been fun being here.
Manny Album has been my guest, and he's a jazz composer and arranger. He now teaches at Glassboro State College, and he's doing some arranging for the Philly Pops. Well, one thing we didn't get to talk about is your scoring for singers, and mm-hmm. I think we have just enough time to listen to a selection that you scored for singer Meredith D'Ambrosio. Can you just talk about this briefly before we hear it?
Yeah, sure. Meredith, I had met her. There was sort of a thing after Alec Wilder had died. A couple of friends, we got together and did sort of a little memorial for Alec, and I heard her sing, and she just knocked me out. She's got a very mature way of thinking about the music, and lo and behold, about 8 months later, she called me up and said, "Hey, I've got an album to do. I want you to write for it and think of something to do." Well, she was thinking about Phil Woods to play because Phil Woods plays exactly opposite of the way she sings. And it's a great foil for her singing. And that's great because Phil is one of my oldest friends and I'm one of his greatest admirers. At any rate, we got Hank Jones to play the piano. We got two of Phil's guys, Bill Goodwin the bass player, Steve Gilmore, to play. And I put together a string quartet for some of the things. And I guess the one we're going to hear is called
The
Wine of May, which has a string quartet as sort of a background. And then Phil comes roaring in where she has been kind of very
restrained.
Yeah, restrained, and she doesn't really sell the song. She, not the way she doesn't belt. She's a very, very intelligent singer, I think. And so this is what it's going to sound like.
Okay, so the singer's Meredith D'Ambrosio. The arranger is Manny Album.
Thank you.
Is for the young to taste. A golden day that's much too sweet to waste. But there are those of us, alas, who let the moment pass and never raise the glass. So it's time for us to learn. We may get stung, but time will heal the burn. This is the only time this day. Let's fall in love and taste the wine of May.
Mm-hmm.